Audience members, it is 3 o'clock and we do have quorum, so let's get started. Thank you. Thank you for your attention. I call this meeting of the House Education Policy Committee to order, and there is a quorum present. Our first order of business is approving the minutes from Wednesday, March 6th. And Representative Keeler, I see that you're settling in and maybe you're glancing at those minutes right now. Would you please move approval of the minutes from March 6th?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move approval for minutes for March 6th.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Any discussion on the minutes from March 6th? Right, hearing none. All in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. The minutes are approved. And first up, we'll have Representative Norris present our first bill. And you can come forward with perhaps a testifier if you have one ready to go. So this is House File 3542, and it is our intention, members, to hear the bill and lay it over for future consideration and possible incorporation of a policy bill.
Thank you, Chair Pryor. And Chair Pryor, I do have an A2 amendment that I'd like to offer.
So we will treat that then as author's amendment, and I will have, again, Representative Keeler, if you would be willing to move House File 3542 before the committee.
Yeah, Chair, I move House File 3542 before the committee.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. And if it's all right with the committee members, we will also move the A2 amendment before the committee for consideration.
So moved.
Any comment on the A2?
The Chair Pryor, the A2 is more or less a delete all amendment. So it basically just gets the bill into the intended form. It reflects the conversations that we've been having with the various stakeholders to make sure everybody's comfortable with the language.
All right. Thank you, Representative Norris. Discussion. All in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 All right. And the A2 amendment is adopted. All right. Well, now that we have the bill set to go, 3542 as amended, please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Chair Pryor, and thank you for the opportunity to be in front of the Education Policy Committee this afternoon. I know we're not supposed to pick favorites with our bills, but this bill might be my favorite this session, and that's because it's a perfect example of how our representative form of government is supposed to work. A dad and his daughter came to me, their state representative, with a powerful story and a desire to make sure the same thing doesn't happen to other Minnesota families. We wrote a bill, worked with all the stakeholders to address concerns and tighten up the language, and now we bring it before you as the next step in the process of it hopefully becoming law. The bill's goal is simple: requiring schools to make reasonable space accommodations for students to participate in mental health appointments by video conference or phone during the school day or before or after school. I don't need to tell you about the mental health crisis that our students are facing. This bill is a good step forward in making sure students have access to the mental health resources they need without having to miss more school to go off campus to receive mental health services. I want to thank the school groups, especially the Minnesota School Board Association and the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, for their collaboration in getting this bill into a form they're comfortable with. We're also pleased to have the support of prominent mental health organizations like NAMI Minnesota. Now it's my honor to turn it over to my constituent, Brian Reynolds, to share his family's story.
Thank you, Representative Norris. So, Mr. Brian Reynolds, if you would introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. My name is Brian Reynolds. As he said, I am a father, so hopefully that's an impressive title for today. Thank you, representatives. Thank you, Representative Norris, for being a staunch supporter of this work and inviting me here to testify today. A few years ago, my daughter needed some help from a therapist. We're privileged enough to be able to afford those services. Her school was more than willing to give her some space at school where she could do virtual meetings with her therapist. After deciding not to return to our home school district after aging out of her chosen school, she chose to attend Centennial High School in Blaine. I reached out to the school counselor to ask about using a room to take her therapy calls during the school year, 1 hour every other week from 3 to 4 o'clock. When nearly every room in that school was open, and really, truly, I thought it was, you know, a no-brainer, that it was just a formality of a request. Unfortunately, I was met with a chorus of no's from the school district, with every response becoming less about logic and reason and more about a seeming turf battle about who controls the school. I went to the Minnesota Department of Education. They told me to file a grievance with the school district, a 504 grievance. I needed a form to do that. So I asked the principal. The principal told me I couldn't have the form. The contacts for the process refused to either answer communications or also denied access to the form. I went elsewhere and got the form. I filed it. They determined internally that there was no violation of 504. They never spoke to me or my daughter during that investigation. On advice of my neighbor, I contacted an attorney who told me to file a complaint with the federal government. I got a 5-minute phone call with the federal government. Then I got an email that said there's no violation. She never talked to my daughter, never talked to the school, and there was no appeal process for that. That was the final decision. So now the question was it time for a lawsuit? Lawsuits cost time and money that no one wants to spend on something like this. Like, it's just a empty room. Meanwhile, my daughter would have to face the consequences of adults not taking simple action. I had contacted every level of government in this country and was now faced with a lawsuit. The entire concept to me was bewildering. At the school district, I found Backdoor, a teacher willing to help. I got my daughter a room to take her appointments. I felt my goal was accomplished. My daughter had the room. She could do her therapy. Problem solved, right? I told my daughter that night. I did not get the response I expected. She said to me, "I appreciate what you did, but what happens to the next kid? Who fights for them? You solved our problem. You didn't solve the problem." And so my then 14-year-old told me I had more work to do. I contacted Representative Norris and told him the story you just heard in much more detail. And that brings us all here today. We as adults often say that we need to do something. This is something we can do. And to me, seemingly, it has no cost. Still seems like an absolute no-brainer. Thank you all for your time and the commitment to serving the people of Minnesota.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay. And for sharing your story. And thank you for your daughter.
Yeah, here, right there.
Right. So at this moment, at this time, we can turn to member discussion and questions. Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Norris. I'll just say I like this idea. One, from a mental health perspective, we know that the increase in supports needed for kids right now is going up. We know that even more after the isolation of the pandemic. We also know from attendance and absence, and what we talk about is students like leaving school to actually go to a physical doctor's appointment. Says one, you have to have transportation as a privilege to get there. Parents have access to leave work to do that. To me, it's a no-brainer that we would make accessibility for students while they're in school most of the year. And I think there's a lot of teachers in the world that would make space for this. There's liaisons, there's support staffs. I do believe that. But I do think that it is something that we need to address, especially as we move more into telehealth and what that needs, and that we have this ongoing understanding that mental health is not just one appointment you go to. It's this ongoing relationship that you build with your therapist in a safe space, and that really should be school. So I appreciate you bringing this. I think that this really is going to solve a lot of those issues and also create opportunity for access to a lot of families that maybe can't have the privilege to get their student, you said, every other week to an appointment and take that time off of work. So I appreciate it. I think it's great when we actually have like constituents in our communities bring the issues that they see in the communities that we're willing to solve. So I appreciate it. Thank you for the work that you're doing around it. And also, I say this every time when we talk about mental health, especially with kids when it comes to suicide, we do have 988 in this state, making sure that everybody who watches us and continues to listen, that is a support for our students as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Representative Norris, thank you for bringing this. And I would echo what Rep. Keeler talked about. Any time that we can have a conversation to address student mental health, we need to work together to figure out how to solve that issue. You talked about telehealth and just the different options. And since the pandemic, it has been really exciting to see how the industry is changing to meet the needs of kids. So my office is right next to our conference room. And especially during the summer, there's a revolving door of kids coming in and meeting with the on-site therapist. But then there's also another space where they are able to access with the Chromebooks that we have, the telehealth. And you talked about MSBA and the different groups. So I think just some practical questions that I have about this. I look at it through the lens of my building. So from 3 to 4 o'clock, that's not a contracted time. Mm-hmm. So who is responsible for the supervision, all of those types of things. Mm-hmm. Any time that space is used after school hours, that's run through our community ed department. So just so that there's not overlap of space. So the logistical pieces have to be figured out, and we would want to make sure that they're clear before we pass this, because what could happen is we say schools must do this. When we say must, schools hear mandate, and we just have to figure that out. And that could be a frustrating thing. Schools will figure out how to meet the mental health kids of needs, or the mental health needs of kids, but we just have to be engaged with it, and it sounds like you have been, which is good. But let's continue that conversation so that we're looking at the broad perspective on just that logistical stuff. Because the last thing I would want to have happen, and my big concern, is that a student is meeting in a telehealth situation in a classroom, in a building, no one's aware of that, and then the kid has a crisis after that session is done. So thank you.
Comments, Representative Norris?
Chair Pryor and Representative Bakeberg, great points. Those are the sorts of things we've been discussing for the past couple of months with the school groups. And I think this bill has the appropriate safeguards and protocols in it for those sorts of things. You mentioned the after school time. The bill specifies that the space is only required to be available after school if there is staff, to the extent staff is available. That's specifically in the bill. Each school must develop a plan with procedures about how they're going to actually administer this, so you don't end up in a situation where a student is just randomly using a classroom that nobody knows about. So we've really tried to be intentional about taking into account those logistical things so that we're making clear that the state has an expectation that schools work cooperatively with parents like Mr. Reynolds to make these spaces available, but also giving each individual school the latitude they need for the logistical challenges of their particular school.
Chair Youakim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, Representative Norris, you perfectly answered my question. Those guardrails yet for the ability for those districts to be flexible and meet their parents' needs, or their students' needs, along with collaborating with their parents is a big part of this bill, and thank you.
Thank you.
Closing comments or questions, Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Norris, thank you for this bill. I think telemental health, those are all important and upcoming things. Just a very quick question. Does school-linked mental health funds, can they be used for this? Let's say a school district needs to get the room set up somehow. Can that funding be used for this?
Representative Norris?
Chair Pryor, Representative Bennett, the bill itself doesn't specifically contemplate that. It might be something that nonpartisan staff might be able to answer for us.
I'm sorry, I missed the beginning of your question, Representative Bennett.
You have to get it from osmosis. whatever. Okay, just wondering if school-linked mental health funding could be accessed for this. We've passed that in the past.
Madam Chair, Representative Bennett, the schooling mental health funding goes to the provider, so the not to the school district, but to the provider of the services. And I don't know the extent to which something like a supply like the computer is, if that's ever provided on the behalf of the SchoolLink mental health provider. I don't know the answer to that.
Thank you. That's okay. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Great. Well, any closing remarks?
Chair Pryor, I'll just echo my thanks to Brian and Brielle for not just solving their own challenge, but saying, what can we do? How can we make the state better for all students throughout Minnesota? It's been an honor to work with them and to partner with them on this journey, and I'm hopeful that by the end of this session, we can declare success and celebrate this actually becoming law.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. Thank you for being with us and bringing forward this idea for a bill. And with that, I will renew Representative Keeler's motion to lay over 3542 as amended for further consideration. And thank you, Representative Norris, for continuing on and the testifiers there, because now we have 3803. All right. And we also have an amendment for this, so we'll want to get to that. All right, Representative Berg, would you like to motion 3803 before the committee to be re-referred to the Education Finance Committee?
Yes, Madam Chair, I so move.
All right, and we have the A2 amendment to get the bill in the order that you would like to have it for discussion. And so, Representative Berg, would you please move the A2 amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the A2 amendment.
Thank you. Any discussion of the A2 amendment, which is how we would like to discuss the bill? Seeing none, all in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. The A2 amendment is adopted. And I think we have the bill ready for your presentation, Representative Norris.
Great. Thank you, Chair Pryor. House File 3803 brings me back to my days actually when I was working at Youth Prize, and we were working with young people across the state on developing a new policy agenda, and we were talking to these young people about what issues were important to them, and one of the issues they brought up was wanting to see more teachers of color in the classroom. So as the policy director for Youth Prize, you know, it was my job to then figure out, okay, how do we take that goal and what actual policies can we put in place? And one of the things when I talked to people in the field about it, they said, well, one of the things you can do is you could, you know, pay student teachers. And I said, what? And they said, yeah, student teachers don't get paid. And I said, what do you mean they don't get paid? They're working. And, you know, it turns out that for most student teachers, those 12 weeks that they spend in the classroom are unpaid. And that creates a significant financial hurdle for a lot of teacher candidates. It prevents those who might be interested in becoming teachers from fulfilling that path. So this bill would create a stipend program, and it would provide state-level stipends for student teachers so that they get some compensation during that time in the classroom to hopefully offset the kind of the financial cost or the time that they're having to spend on that part of their journey toward becoming a teacher. And so with that, I believe we've got a couple of testifiers who can talk more specifically about their own experiences with this.
All right. Thank you, Representative Norris. I do have on my list a remote testifier, Trinity Bryant, a college student at Minnesota State University of Mankato. So if you can hear us, please unmute, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed.
Hello, committee members. My name is Trinity Bryant, and I am a senior majoring in FACTS Education at Minnesota State University, Mankato. I am also a single mother balancing the responsibilities of raising my son and niece while pursuing my dream of becoming a teacher. When I embarked on my journey into student teaching, I was met with a stark reality that I had not fully anticipated. I was told that I would be living on a tight budget with no time to work and advised to put my personal relationships on hold. I had to take all of this in while still recovering from the financial strain of a totaled car and being placed an hour away from home for classroom experience. I was exhausted, overwhelmed, and frankly scared. Scared that I wouldn't meet the required hours, scared that I would fall behind, and scared that I would have to delay my graduation and career goals. Teaching is my passion and is what I've wanted to do since I was a child. I want it to be a beacon of representation, change, love, and the lives of my students. But I never imagined that I would have to sacrifice so much just to fulfill my dream. As a person of color, I recognize the importance of diversity in the teaching profession. Our students come from diverse backgrounds, and they deserve to see themselves reflected in their educators. Kids need teachers like me. Supporting our bill will not only alleviate the financial burden on aspiring educators, but also ensure that the teaching profession remains accessible to all, regardless of race, social, or economic status. State leaders have done so much to try to increase teachers of color in our profession. Rep. Norris' bill to support student teachers would add so much to this movement. By making sure all student teachers can receive a stipend for the time they work in our schools, rather than applying for grants that may go unnoticed by those who need them the most. So today I stand here to call upon our lawmakers and policymakers to invest in the future of education by investing in the future teachers of tomorrow. Let's pay student teachers to ensure that no aspiring teacher has to choose between their passion and their paychecks. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, and we are so fortunate that you will be able to be with us on remote today. And next, I'll turn to Laura Mogelson to introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Laura Mogelson, and I'm here from the Minnesota Association for Colleges of Teacher Education. I'm here today to express our strong support for House File 3803. I'm going to share some contextual information about student teaching in Minnesota and reasons for supporting this bill. As background, teacher candidates must complete a minimum of 12 weeks of full-time student teaching for an initial teaching license. For most teacher candidates, student teaching is an unpaid experience. Just so you know, student teachers are at both the undergrad and grad level. So we have undergraduate student teachers, we have post-baccalaureate student teachers. In fact, 33% of teacher candidates in Minnesota are at that post-baccalaureate level. Many of our students are non-traditional adult student teachers. They come to the profession as career changers or as non-licensed school professionals with or without bachelor's degrees. Our current student teaching expectations began when student teachers were predominantly at the full-time undergraduate level, often supported financially by their parents. Unpaid internships were common at the time. We now recognize that such unpaid expectations disadvantage students from mid to lower financial brackets. Due to this recognition, unpaid internships are now much less common overall. Student teachers frequently report experiencing extreme financial distress and stress during student teaching. Many student teachers do not complete their programs because 3 months without an income is not a viable option. When student teachers have to work evenings and weekends on top of student teaching, they're unable to participate fully. They learn less, and they often experience burnout. We are deeply appreciative of other competitive grant programs that are currently in place. Candidates apply for these the semester before student teaching, but these are not guaranteed. They're also not confirmed until right before the student teaching period or even sometimes during the student teaching period. We recommend building off the success of these programs to allow students considering the field to know that there will be support during student teaching. So thank you, Representative Norris, for authoring this bill. I also want to thank Representative Erdahl, who I've had, MACD has had lots of conversations over the years with Representative Erdahl, who is also supportive of this concept. So thank you, Representative Erdahl. And thank you so much to the committee for listening.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. I have a public testifier, Mr. Matt Schaefer, Matt LS. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Chair Pryor, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Matt Schaefer, and I'm an elementary school teacher and the policy director at Allies. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 3803 as amended. Thank you to Rep. Norris for leading on a bill. There'll be another piece of the puzzle to ensure all students have access to effective and diverse educators. Student teaching is the critical component of a candidate's teacher prep experience. I did my student teaching in Moorhead Public Schools, fifth grade at Ellen Hopkins, Ghost Buds. It was a formative experience in my development as an educator. There are only so many times you can read about the importance of building relationships with students, or so many group projects you can spend practicing unit planning. You have to see it. what it actually looks like to cultivate and tend to student relationships over time. You have to feel what it's like to have 30 sets of eyes on you as you try to lead instruction. And you have to learn how to fail, reflect, adjust, and get yourself ready to try again the next day. Nothing can fully prepare you to be a teacher, but nothing prepares you better for what it's actually like to be a teacher than student teaching. But it's an expensive experience in two ways for pre-service teachers: the cost of the credits and the opportunity cost of working for those 12 weeks, often without pay. These are barriers to teaching that can and should be removed. We support House File 3804 because it works toward addressing the latter in a novel way: pay people for their work. And make no mistake, student teaching is work. All student teachers should be paid a professional wage, and in a year where there may not be enough resources for all the initiative our states need, and tough choices are required, we would urge decision makers to focus on equity and further working toward the diverse teacher workforce our students deserve by prioritizing additional resources for student teacher stipends on demographically underrepresented teachers. I want to again thank Representative Norris for his leadership on this bill and for being open to hearing feedback on it. Thank you to Chair Pryor for the opportunity to testify this afternoon. Thank you all for your public service to our state.
Having no more testifiers, we will turn to member discussion. And I do have Representative Erdahl up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Norris, most of you probably don't know, but, I was a teacher. I was a student teacher, Northview Junior High School. And but I have been long interested in what we can do to make student teaching better. Some years back, Posy Salzberg, the architect of Finnish education, came and visited me in my office. And one of his I asked him, what is so good about the Finnish system? And he said, three things: the teachers, the teachers, the teachers. All of them must have a master's degree in what they teach, and all of them have year-round student teaching. And so I had a bill to promote year-round student teaching. And it actually passed as a pilot program. St. Cloud State and St. Paul College used it. And in their report said that it wasn't workable because the teachers couldn't afford to do it. So that's just a small example of what we're talking about here today. And so I've had bills, I got one this year, to pay student teachers. And when I saw Representative Norris had one, I was glad to sign on. As has been noted, some would-be teachers simply can't afford to enter the profession. When you know that you're going to have to student teach, you probably are in a college, let's say you're in St. Cloud, and you've got a part-time job, and that's getting you through school. And then student teaching comes, and they're going to send you out to Benson, Minnesota to student teach. And you don't have a job there. You have to leave your job that was helping you get through college and pay money to work. And so, you know, it's obvious that something needs to be done. We have a shortage of teachers, and this is one of the things that leads to that shortage. And I don't know exactly what the solution is. I would like to see us get to the time someday when we can do year-round student teaching. And I don't know if the correct method here is to do grants or stipends. You know, maybe the colleges should have a tuition-free student teaching program. We just don't have to pay to student teach. But in any event, I think this is a step in the right direction, and we need to do something to address this problem. So thank you, Representative Norris, for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
Chair Pryor, if I may just briefly, I want to thank Representative Erdahl. I had it planned for my closing remarks, but since he spoke up, I wanted to just briefly thank him for his collaboration and support on this bill. He has been working on this for a number of years. He's got a bill that he introduced this biennium to tackle this issue as well, so it's an honor to be able to work with him and appreciate his support.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your comments. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Pryor. And with your indulgence, is there a way that I could have Laura come back up to the test fire stand, and I have a question for her, Ms. if she's still here.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for returning.
Thank you, Ms. Mogelson, for coming back. I was looking at your handout, and on the little footnote at the end, it says that teachers on the Tier 2 license are able to fulfill their student teaching requirement in their own classroom with university supervision and district mentor. The Tier 2 student teachers would not receive stipends. My question is, are Tier 2 teachers hired by the school and are being paid to do a job?
Ms. Mogelson.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Representative Mueller. So the distinction here is that student teachers that are enrolled in a teacher prep program doing the 12 weeks of student teaching, probably like you did, you know, as a traditional student teacher, are not employees of the district. There are Tier 2 teachers who complete their student teaching while a teacher of record. They are a Tier 2 teacher of record completing their student teaching requirement while they're the Tier 2 teacher. And so our thought is that they shouldn't also get a stipend on top of getting a salary.
Follow-up, Chair Pryor.
You have a follow-up, Representative Mueller.
Thank you so much, Chair Pryor. And thank you for that answer. Listening to the testimony and listening to Chair to Erdahl as Representative Erdahl as he's been talking about this, and you know, this is now that we have the tiered licensing system, we have to really start questioning what the value of a 12-week student teaching experience is, and just having. Because that's what I did 1,000 years ago, right? I was out there, and I was very fortunate to be with my parents, and that's how I was able to afford it. You know, like, I get that that's not everyone's reality. I understand that. But we are, as we are looking at how we are preparing our teachers and the requirements that we're asking them to do, of course they should be compensated. Of course they should have a real life authentic experience to be able to have that practice and that and get a mentor teacher and all those things, which is why I believe, especially since it's already available to our Tier 2 teachers, I think it should be more appropriate for us to look at a system of a residency program instead, where they're hired as a Tier 1 teacher, have a mentor teacher, some sort of system that way. We could even have it where they graduate with a, since we've got rid of the paper pencil test, we need some sort of independent mechanism to make sure that they should get their practitioner's license. Maybe they get a probational license and they get hired on as a Tier 1 teacher and they get a chance to get to be that residency. You already have in here that they're not a part of the bargaining unit and that all of this money doesn't have to count towards, you know, all of their benefits. You know, other professions have residencies that are year-round, like what Representative Erdahl was talking about, that would be more appropriate and would honor the profession of teaching. I was told often by Pelsby that our teaching is a performative profession, and so that's why they got rid of the paper-pencil test. Great. Let's make student teaching a residency program. They get paid. They have a mentor teacher who gets paid, and that they're able to then we're able to then actually have that honoring of that profession. So, again, a step in the right direction, but I really think that this opens the conversation of what student teaching could actually look like rather than simply putting a Band-Aid on something that maybe really isn't appropriate for 2024. Thank you, Representative Norris. Thank you, Chair Pryor.
We're going to go on to Representative Yulkin.
Thank you, Chair Pryor, and maybe either of you, I love this bill. I think we could, like, we don't have a lot of ongoing money this year, but I'm already imagining different targeted pilot projects for districts that have pathways into teaching already. Can you explain to me, though, too, Representative Mueller brings up some good points, but from my understanding, our Tier 2 teachers are in the classroom by themselves. And they might have a mentor teacher, but that mentor teacher usually is also working in a classroom with very little time, especially in elementary, to like push in and see what's going on. Whereas the student teaching model, albeit might be a little long for 12 weeks, I think my son would have said that as well a little bit, but they're working in conjunction with a teacher in the classroom at the same time who can give them the input. I mean, is that's still basically what I'm remembering that, right? Or maybe you can elaborate.
Ms. Mogelson.
Thank you, Chair Pryor, Representative Joachim. So the student teaching model that we are talking about supporting here is that minimum of 12 weeks of student teaching where the student teacher is placed with the trained cooperating teacher who aligns with the licensure area and the scope of the license. We do have more robust student teaching models in the state that are residency models, but they are not, I believe what Representative Mueller was talking about is not a pre-service teaching residency, because we do have pre-service teaching residencies in the state, Minneapolis, St. Paul. They both are running these residency programs where it's a full year of student teaching. But you are, as a resident, you are not the teacher of record. You are co-teaching alongside the teacher of record who has already gone through a licensure program and has experience. So did I clarify and answer your question, Chair Joachim?
We will, thank you. Representative and Joachim. We'll have other discussions during the Finance Committee, too, which we look forward to, and work done before then also. Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Norris. I do. Okay, so can I ask a clarifying question of where we're referring this to?
Education Finance.
Okay. So I just want to take a minute. I do really love this, and I have to, say I was the author of bills that did this in higher education around the teachers of color and Native American teachers, right? So it's not that I hate this idea. I just want to ground us in, where things like this land jurisdictionally. Because we have to remember that student teaching is actually the pathway to earn your degree to become a licensed teacher. I really believe that Minnesota money should stay in Minnesota, right? So if we're going to give money to teachers to finish their education degree to be a licensed teacher, but they're going to move to North Dakota to be a teacher, what did our investment actually do for Minnesota? And we know we have teachers of color, we have grants to student teachers in shortage areas, we have grants for underrepresented student teachers, we have teacher shortage loan repayment. So our higher education committee is doing a lot to address the student debt. And I understand making teachers go to take an entire semester that one they have to pay to do and then not get paid to do it and then take up all the time of their day that they can't go get other jobs is a really brutal way to experience what reality of teaching is going to be, right? And so I think we need to have an honest conversation about where this funding comes from. If we're not making sure that they're turning into Minnesota teachers, like a residency or a fellowship that, you do this in a Minnesota school and then you stay and teach in Minnesota, or we move this financial ask to continue to help the robust areas that we're working in higher education to help offset these areas for individuals who are going to school here. I mean, I really believe that Minnesota students, I would love to turn them into Minnesota teachers. I just want to make sure that this is the right mechanism and the right funding mechanism to do this, that we're not blurring the lines between what higher education would be responsible for and what education policy would be or education finance would be responsible for. So I just don't know if you have an answer or kind of a suggestion back to that. I'm really interested in hearing that, and again, back to kind of leadership on understanding maybe where this lands jurisdictionally.
Mm-hmm. Representative Norris.
Chair Pryor, Representative Keeler, I think you raised great points, especially the notion that if we're going to be investing in these student teachers, we want them to stay in Minnesota and become Minnesota teachers. As we go through the next steps of this bill's journey, I think that's certainly something that we can look at to see how can we try to tailor the bill so we accomplish that objective. So I appreciate the comments you raised.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I won't belabor the point. I'll just say, Rep. Norris, good bill, good comments, Rep. Keeler, and everybody else who commented. I think you have targeted something that's super important, and I want to see us. It brings up a larger point of let's start thinking outside the box, not get stuck with Tier 1, Tier 2, whatever, but just say what's the best way to create a really productive student teaching opportunity that is paid and values our teachers so we can continue these discussions. So thank you.
Thank you. Closing remarks, Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Pryor, and thanks to the committee. I always enjoy coming before education policy. There's so many wise minds when it comes to the field of education on this committee. It always seems like we have very robust discussions and ones where I leave with some great ideas for how to potentially improve the bill. I'll close by just reiterating something that our testifier, Trinity Bryant, said, which I thought was really poignant. You know, she said that we should not have to choose between our passion and having a paycheck. And that, I think, is our ultimate goal, and looking forward to additional steps with this bill to hopefully achieve it. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Berg renews her motion to re-refer House File 3803 as amended to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. The motion carries, and House File 3803, as amended, is on its way to Education Finance.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being with us today. All right, next up will be Representative Feist. And this is House File 4581. All right, Representative Feist, would you like to move House File 4581 before the committee, and it is our intent to lay this over.
Great, yes, so moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and I believe you also have an amendment?
Yes,
yes.
I do, and would you like me to explain the amendment?
Yeah, let's make a brief explanation again.
Yep, the Subdivision 1 just said that the Minnesota School Boards Association will be developing this model policy. They are still going to do so, but we're not creating parameters in statute.
Okay.
So we just deleted that.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, any discussion of the A1 amendment? Okay, seeing none, all in favor of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, the A1 amendment is adopted for your bill. All right.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Okay, thank you so much. And Representative Robbins and I worked on this together, developed it together, so we're co-presenting. As a mother of two middle schoolers, the question of technology in the classroom and cell phone use during the school day is top of mind. I figured I'd go to the experts in preparing this bill presentation, and here are some insights from my kids, who for the record do not bring cell phones to schools, but have many friends who do. My son described lunches where all he does is watch his friends play Pokemon Go. He was not complaining, but I am. He thought that was fine. Both of my children described kids constantly using phones during lunch, on breaks, and during class against the rules. My daughter said the first word that she thinks of when I say the word phones is distracting. And she described an app called Be Real that notifies girls to post a picture of themselves within 2 minutes, and how all the girls pull their phones out, even if it's in the middle of class, to take a picture of themselves and post it. Research has shown that access to cell phones in schools impedes learning, stunts relationships, and lessens a sense of belonging for students. While a common motivation for schools to prohibit phone use has been to eliminate a source of distractions, another has been to help students' mental health by reducing a source of stress and anxiety. In addition, cell phone use during an emergency can increase safety risks as students are distracted from life-saving instructions during a lockdown. The more we understand about cell phones in schools, the more it is clear that we need to be proactive, collaborative, and thoughtful in how and when their use is permitted. The schools in my house district have varying levels of restrictions on phone access and use, and oftentimes the discretion and enforcement is left to the teacher. The goal of this bill is to ensure that all schools have a cell phone policy, and when the Minnesota School Boards Association completes its model policy, that there is a resource for examples and best practices that every school can learn from in developing their policy. And I will turn it over to my representative.
Representative Robbins, if you would introduce yourself for the committee and please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. I'm Representative Kristen Robbins, and it's been a delight to work with Representative Feist on this bill. Through my work on social media, in a different context of trying to limit algorithms, targeting kids with unsolicited content, I found the research on how distracting it is in schools, and I referenced the article in your packet about Dr. Jonathan Haidt and cell-free schools. It's excellent. At the beginning of the school year, that article came out in the Atlantic in August, and I took it to all of my superintendents this fall, and I said, please, let's make a plan in our districts to, I have seven districts, to reduce cell phone use in schools, because the research shows how impactful it is, but it only works if it's building wide, because otherwise there's good teachers who let you have your phone and they're the cool teachers, and then there's other teachers who are the mean, awful teachers who don't let you have your phone, right? And so it has to be a building wide decision and to be effective. And so in my travels, I found my middle school in Maple Grove, Principal Patrick Smith, the only principal in my district doing this, and he has had phenomenal success. And so I look forward to you hearing him. Thank you.
Thank you. And we will now turn to the testifiers on this. First of all, Amy Kujawat. I can't do it. Sorry. Jawatsky. Jawatsky. How about that? I'm getting... If you would introduce yourself for the record, please proceed.
Sure. Hello, committee members. I'm Amy Kajowski. It is a mouthful. I serve as the middle school principal in St. Anthony. Our middle school is a part of the St. Anthony New Brighton School District. And I'm here in support of House File 4581. As you all know, we've seen a significant increase in mental health concerns. Chronic absenteeism, and a lack of connection our kids feel to the school community. The research suggests it is not just the impact of COVID-19, but also the saturation of smartphones and social media in our kids' lives, especially the kids ages 11 to 14, my students, that has led us to this crisis. At our school, St. Anthony Middle School, we went to an off and out of sight policy from the first bell at 8 o'clock to the last bell at 2:45. Both off and out of sight is key. We ask our kids to turn their cell phones off and put them in their lockers if ever we see them, because we know research suggests the further the distance from the students to their phone, the better the chance of learning is. It is key that 100% of my staff is on board. No one lets it slide, so that students know this cell phone practice will be enforced consistently and predictably. This has had a profound impact on our culture. More time to connect, less time to argue, fewer power struggles, and kids secretly tell their families they like it. The Minnesota Principal Survey says principals are seeking support. The mental health needs of our students have require us as principals to create predictable, consistent practices to help our students become more successful. As a building level principal, my teachers and I could put our cell phone practice in place because we had the support of our school board and my superintendent. Requiring schools to have a policy, as House File 4581 lays out, it would allow students to work with their superintendents and boards to ensure they have a smartphone practice in place that is safe and good for kids.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we also have Patrick. For this particular testifier?
This is real easy.
All right. You'd stay a moment.
Ms. Kudowski, I just want to congratulate you for having an eighth grader from your school participating in the state math tournament next week.
That's right. I know that eighth grader well.
What was his name?
Mason. He did a great job in the band concert on Thursday night, too.
Thank you.
I forgot his last name.
Hurdle. Of course.
Got it. All right. Next up is Patrick Smith, principal from Maple Grove Middle School. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Hi, good evening, committee. Thanks for having me here. I'm Patrick Smith. I'm the principal at Maple Grove Middle School in the Osseo School District. All right, I'm just going to tell my story in kind of three chunks, the why, the what, and the how. I'm a new middle school principal. This is my fourth year at Maple Grove Middle. I spent 20 years in elementary, so I found in that time I didn't have a lot of cell phone issues per se. Boy, did I find out the reality when I got into middle school. Taking a job over in the, during a pandemic was a challenge in itself, but the why became very evident. Any issues we had with conflict, whether it was physical or verbal, anything that had to do with kids really getting in any type of conflict, we found to be 100% due to cell phones. Whether it was a post at home, somewhere on social media, a video's being filmed, it just created a very toxic culture. And so we knew the why. The why was we needed to create a space that was safe, positive, and just a great environment for our students. So many conversations with my team, with my wife at home. We also have teenagers that we have gone back and forth on when do we allow them to have a phone. And we just said we needed to do something blunt. We've had a cell phone policy for many years, but there were a lot of gray areas. So we knew we had to change that. And so the what? What did we do? We came up with a policy within our school that was pretty specific and really easy to understand. Cell phones for no reason were allowed from 8:10 to 2:40. I did concede after parent input, after talking to parents, they really, in the times that we have now, there's this big desire to have phones on their child's person. And so we did allow them to have them in school, but knowing that from 8:10 to 2:40, if they were to come out at all for any reason, we take it away. And so the what was, first time we take it away, student gets to pick it up at the end of the day. The second time we take it away, there's a contact home, student gets to pick it up and bring it home. And the third time and every time here on moving forward, if it gets taken away, it's a parent pickup. The what happens? We instantly noticed that it was a game changer. The culture and climate of our building, our students were happy. They weren't looking at their phones during the hallway or at lunchtime. They were talking to each other. They were enjoying the time to be able to have that face-to-face conversation because we spend so many times as teachers of how do we quiet kids down so we can get through content that they don't have that time to socialize. And so we noticed instantly just truly kids are happy. And that's what we wanted to see in our building of 1,600 students to where they're interacting with each other. So it has been a very successful policy that we put in place. It's been well supported by our families and by our entire community. And our teachers love it because the engagement that students have in class is incredible. There is no power struggle. We don't put our teachers in that position. If a student doesn't give up their phone, we go up to get it. We don't make them do that themselves. So thank you for letting me share my story.
Thank you. Thank you for being with us. All right. Member discussion. I know we all can make comments about cell phones, yeah. And it has nothing to do with the way we work. Chair Yuki.
Thank you, Chair Pryor. I just want to thank you both so much for bringing this forward. And I know you've worked with all the stakeholders, and that's how we have the amendment. But I've noticed over the years, sometimes just having a model policy doesn't mean anything if school districts aren't actually adopting that and taking action. So I hope this is just the start of the conversation. And I appreciate your work.
Comments either, Representative Feist or Robbins.
I think our goal was to be, I think we have lots of opinions about what we would like to see all schools do, but the goal is to let schools have that autonomy, but just to ensure that they're prioritizing making these decisions. So, but I agree it's the start of the conversation, not the end of it.
Mm-hmm. And I would just add, Madam Chair, when I talk to my principals and superintendents, they want to do this, and I think having the model policy and having these examples of schools where it's working will help give them sort of a tool to take to their parents or their teachers and help get it on board. I do think this is preferable to a statewide mandate because everyone still has their nuances and in different school districts and also different buildings, you know, different ages, different needs. So I personally think this is a great first step, but it'll be an important tool that they can point to and say, these are best practices. This is what other schools are doing. And my principal Smith has seen when he's spoken at principal conferences, that just gives people courage to go for it.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bennett.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a couple comments. I thank both of you for bringing this forward. I think it's an incredibly good discussion, important topic. I'm a little confused, though. I am actually a co-author on this bill, but my concern is that it was my understanding that there were not mandates on schools in this bill, and that the mandate was actually on the Department of Ed to create model policy, which has been removed, which is fine, but it still does concern me that there truly is a mandate because it is requiring schools to come up with a policy. Granted, most schools probably already do have a policy, but I don't support more mandates for schools because we have inundated them with mandates and they need a chance to catch their collective breaths, and that's a proper way to say that, and initiate what they currently have. So that is a great concern of mine, because it was my understanding that there were not mandates here. And that's on me, because I scanned the bill, and I should have done what I always told myself I'll do, is say, I'll wait, I'll read it, and then come back to it. Hopefully next time I'll do that the proper way. But so I'm not blaming you all, I'm blaming myself. But it does concern me with the mandates, and I know my colleagues are mandate, and my colleagues are as well.
Representative Roberts.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, and thank you, Representative Bennett. Yes, the initial conversation and construction was that it would be a mandate on the School Boards Association to create the model policy, but then the schools could choose to adopt it. But in our research, we were told that most schools have some sort of a cell phone policy, but what's missing is orienting those policies towards phone-free schools rather than just a policy of how you can use the cell phone. And so that's when I believe in the conversation with stakeholders it changed. But yes, I share your concern about mandating new mandates on schools. They have a lot on their plate. But since most have them, I don't personally feel this will be egregious. We just want it that the model policy will be oriented towards reducing phone use in schools.
And Representative Feist.
Yeah, and I would also just say that we worked on this bill with the school stakeholders, so the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, the Minnesota School Boards Association, the Association of AMSD, Association of Metro School Board, whatever, AMSD, the Department of Education, Education Minnesota, the Principals Association, both elementary and secondary, all kind of worked with us to develop this proposal. So they are supportive. So it's not, you know, we're not mandating what they do. We're just saying think about this and be proactive.
So we'll quick hard look at the language one more time as we move towards we'll lane over now, and then we'll see how it moves forward in the final bill, in a final bill. Closing comments.
This is a really important issue. The couple of things I wrote down that our testifiers mentioned is just that 100% of conflict related in some way to cell phone use in schools, and that the goal, it just kind of broke my heart. It's just like we want kids to talk to each other. Like it seems like a simple thing, but that's the goal, is to make sure that these cell phones in schools are not disrupting their educational experience or their socializing and their growth as people.
All right. Well, thank you for the presentation, and thank you for bringing forward this bill and that we could have this discussion and hear these outstanding examples of how an effective policy is being used right now and what a difference it makes in students' lives. So thank you for bringing this forward and bringing your presenters with you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. And with that, Representative Feist renews her motion to lay over House File 4581 for further consideration. All right. And we're moving on. We have Representative Clardy, who's with us today. And it's House File 3372. And members, it is our intention to re-refer this bill to Education Finance Committee. And we do have a number of presenters and testifiers that will be with us. And just a reminder that we have limited time, so if everybody can be sticking with the 2 minutes, and we're going to be timing as we go along, and I may have to interrupt somebody if things go on too long. All right, so, but appreciate that you're all here. And Representative Clardy, let's see, we will have Representative Frazier. Yep. I have to call you, so I just get to see you sometime during the meeting. Thank you. Representative Frazier, would you like to motion House File 3372 before the committee to be referred to the Education Finance Committee?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Frazier.
And then I believe that also we have an author's amendment that is important to this bill to really discuss the bill in the way that we would like to today. So that is the A1 amendment. And Representative Frazier, would you please motion the A1 amendment before us?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. And this essentially is the way the bill should be discussed today. And so I would recommend that we adopt the A1 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. All right. Then the A1 amendment is adopted. All right. Thank you. Representative Clardy, please introduce your bill.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Pryor and committee. I am going to do three quick points. I've got some amazing testifiers that will dig in. So this bill will establish micro-credentialing pathways for existing licensed teachers. And the second thing is it'll assure that there's more support in the ALC, the Area Learning Centers, because they've been greatly understaffed. And then the third thing is it's establishing a task force that will look at how to fully fund the EL learner programs and the ALC programs and just looking at the best practices toward ELs. So I'm going to turn it over to my first testifier, Chair Pryor.
All right. Dr. Reverend Hillstrom.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. Thank you so much for allowing us the opportunity to be here today. Asio Tohojo, greetings. To build a prosperous future for all Minnesotans, we must fundamentally transform the historical systems and structures that continue to disenfranchise students of color and American Indian students. Those are the opening words and research that has come out of the Minnesota Educational Equity Partnership that supports this bill. If you recall the LEAPS Act from 2014, transformational, theoretically. And yet we're still looking at issues that are connected to our EL learners in this area of micro-credentialing, of staffing ratios, of professional development, of college prep work. As we recall, the LEAPS Act suggests that there's four basic provisions: multilingualism as an educational asset and as an economic asset. This idea that teachers and administrators need to receive appropriate preparation and professional development, the idea of instructional differentiation for diverse multilingual learners, and of course multicultural families' voice in engaging in this. I'm not sure if we're aware of this in our state right now, but we have 543 districts. There, of that 543, there are over 100 of those currently with EL learners with no EL FTE. Did you hear me? Over 100 of them, approximately 20%. Let's go further down. Numbers of districts, and of course I won't go too long here, but with serving over 100 students to 128. It's egregious. It's egregious. To do this effectively, we need to make a shift towards culturally validating pedagogy and leadership. And through that research that I mentioned through Manip, you can learn more about that. But the concept of this, both in micro-credentialing and professional development, needs to continually support the development of these students, the staff. Teachers are committed deeply to effectively supporting students. And yet when you ask them often, they'll say, I don't know how. And that's why we have the over-representation of EL students within special ed. Being a multilingual person is not a disability.
Thank you. If you can wrap it up.
Absolutely. So as I say, we need to look at these structures, and the way that we perceive to do that is listed in this bill. There are opportunities to provide professional development to really thoughtful and capable people, as well as micro-credentialing that can help us begin to answer some of these questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next step up, I have Nan Ureco from Race Equity and Training Center, and after that, Irma Trapero. If you can be ready to come down. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Nan Ureco. I'm the Race Equity Training Center Coordinator at MNEAP. Micro-credentialing in EL for licensed administrators would provide opportunities for them to improve their EL-specific capacity. meaning their knowledge, skills, and will, and to increase their EL-specific consciousness, conviction, and commitment to better serving EL students. The BOSA-created rule on EL micro-credential could support culturally validating pedagogy and leadership and benefit district administrators, principals, program directors, and coordinators of EL in four primary areas. One, instructional leadership, to learn current EL best practices that address environment, instruction, and content. Two, data, to learn how to collect and analyze access and other data in the decision-making connected to EL education. Three, relationships, to understand the systemic structure and limitations regarding effective communication and engagement with EL students and their families. And four, finance, to understand the current model combining traditional formula with cross subsidies and how EL funds are being used within their organization. The goal would be to build the capacity for licensed administrators to better lead, support, and administer EL programs, services, and staff. I was a principal at schools with large EL populations, and later as an assistant superintendent in a very small district, I inherited the role of EL director. I had no background in EL. As a result, I am certain my leadership failed EL students, their families, and staff. Thank you for considering this bill. I implore you to act.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. After our next testifier will be Michelle Higgins.
Buenas tardes a todos and members of the committee. My name is Irma Marquez Trapero, and I am the CEO of Latino Lead. At Latino Lead, we envision a world where our Latinx community is civically engaged, connected and supported, and seen as a vital force of influence in Minnesota. And of course, one of our top priorities is education. At Latino Lead, our education action team represents parents, teachers, educators, government, business, leaders, and diverse voices that strongly support this bill, a bill that supports our educators, ELL parents, like mine, and most of all, ELL students. I'm also here today supporting this bill on behalf of our community, but also because once an ELL kid, always an ELL kid. I came to the U.S. at age 9 and grew up in St. James, a greater Minnesota town about 2 hours south of here. I can truly say I was privileged to have Mrs. Bradley, my ELL teacher, in a small group of other recent arrivals in 1999. At the time, Latinas in Minnesota, in St. James specifically, were a small percentage of the overall population. Now, more than half of the elementary schools are at over 50%. Latinos or immigrants or ELL multilingual learners. And as we have seen in recent years, we have also welcomed new arrivals and students into our school districts. It's a critical moment to support this, especially the way we engage parents. As this bill states, parent and community advisory councils will provide counsel and feedback to the Department of Education and English language programs, funding levels, and statewide administrative oversight of ELL revenue program. We must invest in ways to build with our EL parents. I wish my mom would have had the opportunity to be engaged in ways that are culturally specific, meets parents where they are at, but most importantly, engagement that is prioritized, holistic, and invested in. Finally, as our immigrant community continues to grow and call Minnesota home, like my family did 24, 25 years ago, this effort is needed now more than ever, and this is why I urge you to vote in support of this bill. Thank you so much for carrying this forward.
Thank you. Michelle Higgins is up next, and after that, Zeke Jackson. Thank you. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michelle Higgins, and I am the Executive Director of Rebuilding the Village in St. Paul. I've worked with students of all ages for over 30 years. Having worked in both traditional and non-traditional settings, I've learned that students that have people who believe in them, encourage them, and advocate for them are the ones that succeed.
Having someone in the academic setting to help them understand their options can be the difference between failure and success. Student support personnel aid to ALCs is critical to ensuring the success of students who are already facing a plethora of unique challenges to completing their education. And without this support, many will never graduate from college. These are smart, motivated students who are often relegated to an inferior status in the academic community simply due to life circumstances. Far too many of our ALC students have already been written off as unsuccessful, failures, or students who will never be college material, and yet quite often are the ones that put the most effort into being successful in their academic careers. The largest number of ALC students are Black, Indigenous, other students of color, and English learners. These same groups are the lowest number of students participating in dual enrollment programs. The PSEO dual enrollment system was put in place as a step to ensure that all students have a chance to earn a college degree. But systems are only effective if they can be accessed. I've heard story after story from my students who were not aware that these programs exist. They were told they weren't eligible to participate or that they were probably not a good fit for those programs. The language in this bill will ensure that the state-approved alternative programs have the needed resources to support our students having access to the same programs as students in regular education schools. We have put the steps in place to help our students. Now let's give them the banister to help guide and support them as they climb those steps to success. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Zeke Jackson, and then after that, Quilla Pringle. Sorry. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, evening. Zeke Jackson, Executive Director at People for PSEO. Madam Chairs and members of the House Education Policy Committee, I'm speaking in support of the expansion of school support personnel in area learning centers across Minnesota to enhance and support participation in PSEO and concurrent enrollment programs. In my role at People for PSEO, I've worked with EL students, other ALC students, their academic advisors, and I believe that Michelle spoke very well in favor of this, and I just want to add a couple new points. The first is that concurrent enrollment and PSEO have a track-proven policy record, both inside and outside of Minnesota, in terms of closing racial and ethnic disparities in high school and college graduation rates, even among students that aren't traditionally considered to be ready for higher education. The academic phrase that I'm most familiar with is academic momentum. Participating in these programs changes the students' perceptions of themselves, of what they're capable of the institutions that they belong to, it develops their skills in organization and time management, and much more. In addition, I think that this is actually an ideal time to encourage college enrollment. It can change a great deal when our students are taking their very first college courses with the added benefits and support structures and communities that they're getting from their area learning centers. Expanding school and support personnel for dual enrollment students and area learning centers is a forward-thinking strategy that I believe will deliver for the state as a whole. Thank you for considering this important initiative.
Thank you. Ms. Pringle, you would come forward, and after that, Dr. John Peterson.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kulia Pringle, and I am the Minnesota State Director for the National Parents Union. I am also an immigrant to the United States. I am also a secondary urban education teacher. I am here today on behalf of the EL families we serve in support of House File 3372 and the amendment. Our families want to ensure there is a legislative task force on fully funding EL and ALC programs. It is our understanding that the state may be in direct violation of federal and state laws from data we've seen that shows over 100 schools are out of compliance with civil rights for having no EL FTEs to serve services that are legally mandated for EL students. There are also some schools that are in violation of having staffing ratios far below the ability to meet the standards set by law. We also want to ensure that the voices of those who are impacted by a lack of adequate EL services to be at the table where decisions are made about their families' educational journey and not just a sounding board to hear their issues and nothing be done. Thank you.
Thank you. And Dr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Leotawa Dr. John Peterson. I am the Senior Policy Fellow for the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership, MNEP. I'd like to read a statement on behalf of our Executive Director, former Representative Carlos Mariani Rosa. Dear Minnesota House Education Policy Committee, first, thank you for your service to our state. As a former legislator, I recognize the hard work and commitment it takes to serve our people well in fashioning a state that makes a positive difference in their lives. As you ponder this bill today, I ask you to consider that our state has set a high bar for EL students to achieve academic English while also meeting all state standards. We passed the nation-leading Minnesota LEAPS Act over a decade ago to affirm that high bar and to provide guidance to schools on how to meet that high bar while also honoring the home languages and cultures of our students. Even within that policy framework, however, Minnesota still suffers from a capacity issue, particularly of not having enough ESL licensed teachers to meet the legal mandates for services that go back to the unanimous 1974 U.S. Supreme Court case of Lau v. Nichols. 50 years ago, Lau v. Nichols established that the lack of supplemental language instruction in public school for students with limited English proficiency violated the Civil Rights Act of 1964. As you deliberate today, there is litigation being proposed to challenge Minnesota not meeting our obligations to both LEAPS and Lau v. Nichols. Manit believes Representative Clardy's proposals in the bill before you today provide some initial answers to the obligations that Minnesota LEAPS and Lau v. Nichols asks of you as legislators. Manit has informed her bill with strong research, and we have shared with her the expectations we have learned from our interactions with families and with schools, and all of it aimed at building up Minnesota's capacity to produce more EL competent teachers and to develop better knowledge of what it takes for EL students to achieve state academic standards. Thank you for seriously considering this first step of working toward developing powerful learning environments for EL students, consistent with the law and with your best hopes and aspirations for our students. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Members, we still have another bill and the testifiers are here today. And I'd like to be able to present the other bill and have those testifiers that were here today to be able to go on. But I think that we had great testimony. I appreciate everybody that spoke right now. And I think there will be questions and member discussion on this bill before we take a vote on it. So what I would like to propose is if we can make a note of what our questions are or and continue this discussion and questions if folks can come back tomorrow, or maybe we could get a couple questions now that we have time for, if there's some that are imminent and we want. But I think that if I can ask you back tomorrow for the continuation of this discussion, would you be available?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to come back tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you. And do we have questions that we want to? We will definitely have discussion, but do we have questions that we'd like to have addressed right now in the next few minutes with the testifiers when things are fresh on your mind? We'll wait. All right. Thank you. Thank you. And we will set a time in tomorrow's agenda to make sure that we can cover this, because there was a lot of material that you've given us, and we do want to get into it. So thank you. I will make the choice then of just laying the bill over until tomorrow, where we'll continue the discussion for it that day.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for the presentation today. We very much appreciate all of you that were here. And come back tomorrow. All right. And with that, the last bill is mine. So I will relinquish my seat.
Welcome to your own committee, Chair Pryor. As you get settled, go ahead and move House File 4611 before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in a ed policy omnibus bill.
All right. Thank you, Tara, and that is my motion.
And then, Chair Pryor, I believe you do have a DE1 amendment. Did you want to lay that over, and we'll get the bill in the shape you'd like, and then we can talk about it.
Great. Yes, I'd like to move the DE amendment, please.
Members, the DE1 amendment's before us. It gets the bill in the shape the author would like, so we're going to vote on that first. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The DE1 amendment's adopted. Chair Pryor, your bill's in the shape you'd like, and go ahead.
And I'm realizing now that the notes that I had for my presentation are probably over there in my backpack. But I know that I have with me a very competent presenter for this particular bill. And with that, I would like just to say that, introduce my testifier, my former colleague, and my seatmate, as in sat next to each other on the floor. Don't say representative. County Commissioner Lori Halverson. Here is from where I, the need for this bill came forward. And with that, I would like to turn it over to my presenter.
Thank you. Welcome back to the Minnesota House. Former Representative Lori Halverson, please state your name and title for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Lori Halverson, and I am a Dakota County Commissioner. In this capacity, I also have the pleasure of serving as the Vice Chair of MELSA, which is the Metropolitan Library Service Agency. We call it MELSA. I actually had to look up what it stands for because I forgot. The MELSA is a coalition of seven metropolitan libraries that works together under our executive director to provide services, to provide programming, and to provide training and a funding stream for our libraries. So MELSA acts as a financial pass-through organization, often for state and federal money as well, to our local libraries. And this idea came to us because our executive director is retiring. The MELSA Board of Directors went through a hiring process with an executive director about 5 years ago. And when we learned that the executive director was going to retire, I heard quite quickly from folks who had been through that hiring process before that the Master of Library Science requirement that is in state rules was a burden, was a hurdle to them getting the kind of diverse and large applicant pool that they were hoping for. They posted more than once in terms of trying to find people to apply and did not get the pool that they were hoping for. So they very quickly reached out to the board. As vice chair, I chair the personnel committee, and they said, this is a big concern for us with this upcoming hiring process. Can we perhaps change state rules? And so here we are with the help of Representative Pryor. The amendment makes this bill very clear that this is only a MELSA requirement that would be changed. It would not impact the other 12 regional library systems. It's important that other parts of the state who do run libraries. MELSA does not run libraries. We have seven library directors who run libraries, and those are very often MLS or MLIS educated library directors. And what we really want is to be able to attract an applicant pool and attract a leader that is going to represent and reflect the patrons that we are serving in metropolitan libraries. And what we know is that only about 14% of holders of MLS degrees are people of color. And we serve a much higher percentage of communities of color in our metropolitan libraries. And the future, and I talk often about what a 21st century library is going to look like and the way we're going to serve our communities. In order to build for that future, we want to be able to hire a leader that reflects the people that we serve. And I have much smarter people than me that help me learn about all these issues. And our Dakota County Library Director is also here as a member of the MELSA Advisory Board to visit about this bill.
Thank you so much. Next testifier, Director Margaret Stone. Please get settled, state your name for the record, and proceed. Proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I am Margaret Stone, Director of Dakota County Library, which is, I have to make one correction here. There's actually 8 library systems in the Metropolitan Library Service Agency, known as MELSA. There are 7 counties and 1 city. Some of you may be aware that St. Paul Public Library is a city-run library within MELSA. I'm here in support of House File 4611. So I have a master's degree in library science from the University of Maryland, College Park, and I'm really proud of that degree. Using the knowledge and the values that I learned from earning that degree over the course of my career, I've helped connect individuals with information they wanted or needed to find their success. I've developed library services and programs which promote learning, built community, and offered some fun for library customers who visit the library. I've also managed library spaces and supervised other librarians to make those spaces welcoming and inclusive. And most recently, I've supervised selection staff and helped defend against book challenges. My MLS, Master's of Library Science, helped me with all of this. However, the executive director of MELSA is not expected to develop library services nor respond to book challenges. And in that way, it is different than the other regional library systems. The main responsibility of the MELSA director is to facilitate and support 2 boards, manage a budget, supervise staff, and plan strategically. That knowledge and skills can be found in many different degrees. Removing the requirement for the master's in library science for just MELSA will allow for that broader pool of applicants. But this is not to exclude individuals with an MLS from applying, but rather to welcome that broader pool, people with different backgrounds and experiences to apply. It's a struggle to attract MLS or MLIS holders who identify as Black, Indigenous, or people of colors. And this will help us find the leader that we're searching for. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Director. Next up, we'll move to public testimony. We have Jody Grubanowski, President of the Minnesota Library Association, and Megan Ariola, Legislative Coordinator, MDE. Please get settled, state your name for the record, and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Jody Carlson Grubanowski, and I'm actually here from Virginia, Minnesota. I was supposed to be virtual, but I made it. I am here as the president of the Minnesota Library Association to speak about the importance of the rule that you're discussing today. I am a degreed librarian. I have had my degree for many years. This degree, as pointed out, has given me a foundation and understanding of how libraries work. Everything from ILS, which is integrated library systems, like every profession you have, you've got your acronyms, including collections, ordering the right collections for the communities you served. You're required to take core courses. So professional positions require professional degrees. The master's degree from an accredited program assures that we as librarians have a shared vocabulary, a shared understanding of how libraries work, a shared goal of providing the best library service to our population, as well as the skills necessary to define best library service and population. Public libraries and public service agencies are not NGOs, and they're not businesses. From the outside of this profession, it's hard to know what skills are needed to do the job with excellence and why the Library Association accredited programs produce professional librarians. The 12 regional library systems have been designated by the Minnesota Department of Education as agencies charged with strengthening, improving, and promoting public library services across Minnesota through cooperation, shared services, and reciprocal borrowing agreements. Regional public libraries provide users with access to a wide range of political services. And somebody who's in northern Minnesota, I can tell you that really does happen. And within the region and statewide, and sometimes even beyond. The system collaboration communities developed, they capitalize on economies of scale, providing greater effectiveness, improved quality, and access to more resources. In addition, the 12 regional libraries' chief administrative officers worked together to discuss commonalities among the systems, identify potential collaborations, and work towards statewide goals. In order to do that, the chief administrative officer has to have a solid foundation in the nature of public library work in Minnesota. The Minnesota Library Association vision for libraries is to thrive now and into the future. Minnesota libraries do better when we all do better, and Minnesota libraries thrive, public libraries thrive together. We need a chief administrative officer for all regional public libraries to have both practical experience in public library administration, theoretical foundation knowledge attained through their degree. So please continue support for Minnesota public libraries by maintaining the integrity of Rule 3530.100(a). Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your time. And we have one more testifier for the remaining of our minutes, and then we will be laying this bill over for further discussion tomorrow as well. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Megan Adiola. I'm the legislative coordinator for the government relations team at the Minnesota Department of Education. I'm here today to share some thoughts and just some concerns from the department on the bill before us that we hope the committee will consider when building your final omnibus. MDE State Library Services works with public and school libraries across Minnesota to support lifelong learning as well as administer various funding streams to support these libraries. As part of that work, MDE is charged in statute with promulgating rules for the implementation of library grant and aid programs. One of the rules that's been promulgated is the one we're discussing here today, which requires the chief administrative officer of a regional library system to have at least 2 years of experience and hold a master's degree in library sciences. This rule has been in place for a number of years, and we'd like to share with the committee why we believe keeping this rule is important for our state libraries. An MLS or an MLIS degree not only includes courses on the fundamentals of working in a library, like cataloging, information system design, and research methods, but it also includes education on the history and theory of library science, institutional management, and information behavior. These topics are not taught in other degree programs and are essential to the guidance and leadership of libraries. Libraries are not like businesses or even other areas of public administration. We believe that individuals leading in the space should have a commitment to the profession and a demonstrated understanding of library sciences that are essential for effectively serving library patrons and meeting diverse needs of a community. And that's why the rule establishing the master's degree in library science was established. We are absolutely sympathetic and understanding of the desire to expand the candidate pool and open the door to more diverse candidates, and MDE is happy to consult with the board on their recruitment efforts and to work with the legislature to talk about ways to create more diversity in MLS and MLIS degree holders. Stemming from MLS's request to MDE for a waiver on this rule, we're in the process of setting up a meeting with some of our board members. I believe that should be happening shortly, and we hope we're able to have a continued fruitful conversation with these groups. We do want to just raise a few considerations around finances related to this change, most notably the Institute of Museum and Library Sciences, the federal agency that distributes library funding, requires an MLIS holding librarian for a library to receive those funds. Waiving that requirement for one or more regional systems like MLSA would make some of those libraries in the system ineligible for funding to apply for federal LSTA funding, which I talked about before, on behalf of their member libraries if their executive director does not have this degree. If their member libraries as well do not have an MLIS holding director, as we know is difficult in this day and age, then these libraries would also not be eligible. So two parts there. So if the MLIS requirement is eliminated, a regional library system would no longer be able to report on behalf of its members to the regional library basic systems of support aid, and that means that each member library would be responsible for this reporting and application of state funding on their own. The purpose of a regional library system is to maximize cooperation and provide shared services and efficiencies, and they rely on these federal funding sources as well as state funding sources for their member libraries to support this work. The state's 12 regional library systems serve an important role, and we want to make sure they can continue to do that, and we appreciate the committee's time here today. Look forward to continuing this discussion with Chair Pryor, with the testifiers that were here today, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Chair Pryor. Is it your intention to lay House File 4611 over?
It is my intention.
And
If I can just quickly say too, 3372, the previous bill, if people could put that in their save folders, we will be taking that up in our next meeting. And I know that it's not in the flow of what we're talking about right now, and I apologize.
Chair Pryor, will we be taking up the discussion around this as well, too?
Yes.
All right. Members, if you hold your questions, write them down. We'll take this up tomorrow. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you.